Welcome back to the roundtable panel, or rather, welcome to the start of the roundtable panel for this morning. I am Sarah LeDuc, and for Joe Donahue today, he's scheduled to return tomorrow. Here in studio with me for the show this morning, Joseph Palamountain, Jr., Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin. Good morning, Beau. How are you?
Good morning, Sarah. I'm great, especially in light of the fact that it's the second time in a row we're together, and Judy, and one of my all-time favorite co-panelists, Mark Whitman, is here as well.
I was supposed to introduce them. That's my
I'll
job.
I'll take that back.
Obviously fine, just playing. Former Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, is here. Hi, Judy. Are you equally happy to be on with Beau again, or no?
Let's start Indeed I am, but sad that my daffodils were covered with snow this
yes,
morning.
I think my forsythia is going to be stopped where it is and then just turn green. But
we had them for a few days.
Viva the Northeast, right? We're also joined by investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. Hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm good, Sarah. I'm thrilled to be here, despite the state of our world. Although I guess the universe is okay. Yeah. Apparently the dark side of the moon is still there and everything's good.
And it's kind of tie-dye. There's color on the moon. I saw it in a photo. I'm psyched about it.
That's a green, I hear.
I shudder to think how much each of those photos cost us, but that's a whole nother discussion.
That's not a bad point. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Maybe you can bring us down even faster than Mark has, but that's valid and defensible.
Sorry.
No, we appreciate the honesty. I don't see a point in being falsely optimistic currently. Speaking of which, after 16 years in power, this from the New York Times, Prime Minister Viktor Orban of Hungary is struggling to maintain his footing as his governing Fidesz party trails badly in most polls. Now, American Vice President J.D. Vance is attempting a last-ditch effort to revive the flagging prospect of Europe's nationalist standard bearer, declaring that Hungary under Mr. Orban's leadership and the United States under President Trump are, quote, bound by moral cooperation in the defense of Western civilization. Mr. Vance told a news conference in Budapest, the Hungarian capital, that Viktor Orban is, of course, going to win. Let's discuss. Mark.
I was shocked to hear J.D. Vance's pronouncements. I guess Marco Rubio went to Hungary and performed similar service on behalf of Orban. He is such he's so illiberal. He's done so much to degrade democracy. And I think that if the Democrats are skilled, that if either of J.D. Vance or Rubio raise their hand or their head above the parapet to run for president, I can't wait to see them wear this. The other big proponent of Orban is Russia. And that's because Orban has used his position within the EU to gum up the works as much as he can and slow the provision of aid and defense to the besieged people of Ukraine. I find it shocking that there are two American politicians that see it within their writ to support somebody like him. And I think that if their political opponents in the future exhibit even a modicum of skill, they will hopefully wear this as a badge of infamy for the rest of their sad public careers.
Judy.
First of all, what are we doing going to another country and lobbying for one candidate over another? It's not like he's not like he's going to Ohio to electioneer for a Senate candidate. This is the Vice President of the United States going to another country to campaign for an established strongman who has worked to undermine democracy for the last 20 years. You know, last week, Tonight with John Oliver had a great piece on Viktor Orban, not this past week, but the week before, that's still around if anyone wants to check it out. That really detailed his rise and then his reign of terror the last, you know, again, 20 years. This is something that President Trump aims to replicate here among us. I mean, even his oppression of the media is the thing that I pay attention to. It has been severe. Again, what are we doing? How would we feel if Macron came to the U.S. to lobby for one presidential candidate over another? We don't do this. We shouldn't be doing this.
Well,
Yeah, I agree, obviously, with both Judy and Mark on this. Let me just say a couple things, though. I'm sure listeners are going to correct me, but I believe this is Vance's first trip abroad in 2026. He may have gone one other time. But he chooses this one, as Mark says, and as Judy doubles down on, he chooses this as the opportunity, as the thing to do on a trip abroad. And let's think about for a minute Hungary. Hungary at one time was a very promising economic country. It had a pretty sizable GDP. It was a pretty functioning economy. It's now the lowest in the European Union. And so when you juxtapose that reality with Vance saying today that Orbán is the model of statesmanship in the European Union, it strikes me that really, what this administration and Vance in particular is focused on is the nationalism, the anti-immigration, sort of the social non-economic elements that are so central to the Trump administration. The illiberalism that Mark talked about is exactly right. So for Vance to go there, and remember, the one of the interesting things about the race is that Orbán's running against a conservative. So Orbán is the far right candidate compared to the other candidate. It's not like there's a liberal progressive in the race. Vance is actually looking to support the farthest right nationalist candidate, not just a conservative candidate. And it says something dramatic about the way in which this administration both sees the global world as sort of a nationalist, anti-immigration, lets other, non-European folks, but also the fact that those who are on the far right are always going to get Trump's attention and support.
This doesn't undermine any of your further points, but Vice President Vance did go to the Olympics in Milan and then stopped in Armenia and Azerbaijan on the way back. So just to be clear.
Oh, not only does that not undermine, if I may, if you remember, he took ICE agents with him in a non-operational role, but in a way in the wake of the killings that we had seen, let's call them homicides that we had seen.
Yes.
So, I mean, just to prove how illiberal this man is, when he leaves American soil, he still takes with him his special agents at a time when their presence anywhere, let alone on foreign soil in a non-operational role, was a particular sign that he wanted to send to his base. I find this amazing. I've noticed that people have started calling it the Trump-Vance administration. Mm-hmm. Can someone tell me? I've assumed I know why that is, but I don't know that I'm sure I know why we've started calling it that. I've assumed it's because they're afraid that Vance is becoming a front runner for the next presidential election, and they want to taint him with all the goodness that we're seeing from this administration. But I don't know if there's another reason we're now calling it the Trump-Vance administration.
I hear that, especially from Democratic operatives. Yep. They like to not just refer to the Trump administration, but Vance, because they are trying to draw him into the make him accountable for what the whole entire administration is doing and they're planning for whatever happens next.
And to this point, I think you're right. And to this point, he has stayed largely under the radar. He doesn't get the airplay, and I'm not so sure any vice president really gets the airplay, but he doesn't get the airplay that could put him in a delicate position going into 2028. Now, there's plenty of time left. All the more reason, Mark, what you said early on, it's shocking that he chooses this as sort of the public moment.
Yeah, I guess he's appealing to that mega base, and the assumption is, as a Republican, that you still need, and you are going to still need to cater to it in order to prevail in the primary that would be relevant to him in the next presidential cycle. But I find it amazing. The other interesting thing is, you could almost say the same if it wasn't for Cuba. Marco Rubio could also be turned under the radar.
Right, it's true. But let me ask the three of you, how is it that a a public moment in Hungary is going to appeal to the MAGA base that he needs to be successful in 2028. Why? How is it that this is the one of the things? Now, we'll forget about it shortly, but what's the advantage to going to campaign for Orban to your base here at home?
I don't know if there is one.
I would argue.
I think they'll count on them forgetting it, but it's the allyship with Russia and Orban and maintaining that.
Orban had been invited over to speak at, and I'm going to get it wrong, if it was CPAC or another conservative conference. CPAC. And he was, in a way, the poster child, right? And he uses xenophobia. He uses
LGBTQAI plus.
Thank you.
You got it.
And they're illiberal towards the press. We could go on with the list, but it's a lot of things that MAGA sort of all cheers when you throw them the red meat. So I assume that's why he's going, that there is that part of the MAGA culture that watches these things carefully. And again, what I take from this is that he and Rubio realize that you've got to have that base on side in order to emerge from the Republican scrum in the next presidential cycle. So I assume that's why he's doing it. I don't know. Why does he bring ICE with him to Italy, right? Is it to show every American that during this time when they were rightfully under scrutiny for the abuses domestically? And why is it that President Trump sends ICE to the airports? I mean, there is this sort of playing to a really deep, dark base, frankly. When I say dark, I mean sort of dark motivations within that base.
I would argue there's a MAGA establishment, and then there's the rank-and-file MAGA who couldn't put Hungary on a map if they needed to, even on a continent maybe. And I think he's playing to the MAGA establishment that he's hoping to ingratiate himself with the movers and thinkers and the financial aspect of those who fund MAGA movements going forward. He's also trying to, ingratiate himself with the president because, he's following along the president's line. He has been particularly sly about trying to avoid direct connection with what's happening in Iran. I think he is not at the forefront of what's happening. I mean, today we're at a crucial phase of this war with Iran, and he is over in Europe. So he's distanced himself geographically as well from it.
I'm sorry, Judy, could we just use the proper term? Excursion, please. It's an excursion.
Okay, so here's also the great irony about this is not only is the Trump administration critical and just apoplectic about Russian interference in our election, but, in some ways, we don't want interference in our election from whatever it is. And here, Vance is going over there and, quote-unquote, interfering in some way in their election. Is it that there was clandestine secret interference on the part of Russia that makes that bad and what Vance is doing okay? I find interference abroad in an election problematic, whether it's here or there.
You naive fool. No, I'm kidding. Obviously, that is...
Don't you? I guess... I know we have rules around campaign donations.
For sure.
But I don't...
And they're all followed.
Yes.
But there's nothing technically stopping Emmanuel Macron from showing up on Fifth Avenue and expressing his political preferences. If it's above board, I think that's very different than what was alleged to have happened below board, whether or not, given how much the Trumps participated in or knew of it in the last election. I mean, it's clear that there were all these troll farms. Actually, they were in Ukrainian territory run by the Russians that did try to give an assist in 16 to Trump. How much, and they sort of keystone copped into collusion, not collusion, that sort of gray area that they ended up in. I find that offensive. I suspect it's technically illegal in the United States, and it should be. If Emmanuel Macron wants to show up on Fifth Avenue and express his preference, good for him.
But he won't.
Well, okay. But, I mean, sure.
So I guess from the, I don't know what the rules are in Hungary, right? And so if J.D. Vance wants to go express preference for one world leader over another, that's probably a bad idea, but I don't think it's technically against U.S. law. And if he,
no.
my point is, if he wants to do it for somebody who is illiberal and distasteful, is Viktor Orban, then he should wear that as a badge for the rest of his political career here in the United States, or unless and until he credibly expresses his regret and remorse for doing
so. I totally agree.
I don't see that coming.
No.
No, I'm just saying there are ways. You look at my version of the political world. You can make desperate mistakes and redeem yourself. I believe in that. So, until and unless, right, he ought to wear this.
Yes,
for sure. And I couldn't agree with you, Mark. I couldn't agree more with you, Mark, on that particular issue. If Macron comes and campaigns on Fifth Avenue, and it's above board, it might just not have the label of slimy. But at the end of the day, I think Judy said this, when was the last time a U.S. president or vice president literally went abroad and campaigned in another country for whomever? I can't remember a single time, and I'm sure there's a reader who's going to say, yeah, Ike did it, or, you know, whatever. But at the end of the day, it still is some level of influence and some level of, you know, tit for tat. And, you know, so the reality is I'm not comfortable even if one is slimy and under the radar and one's not.
We believe in self-determination as a country. And I know the CIA and has worked to undermine, you know, governments all over the world. I know that has happened. But above board, overtly, we should allow countries to determine for themselves how they're going to be governed.
A few quick emails before BBC. Stephanie says, Orban is the link between the EU and Putin. He is also the role model for rigging elections. We heard from John, who says, Orban is rapidly, viciously homophobic and has been attacking the Hungarian LGBT plus community with high saturated vigor, and the majority of the rest of Europe dislikes him for that. We also heard from Jackie, who says Vance is supporting not only nationalism, but tyranny. Teresa says the connection is not hard. They're all fascists, and that's where they are taking us. And the rest are too long to read before the break. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We will return with Beau Breslin, Judy Patrick, and Mark Whitman after news from the BBC. Again, the email address to participate is panel@wamc.org. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue this morning, here with Beau Breslin, Judy Patrick, and Mark Whitman. The email address to participate in the conversation, should you wish to do so, is panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Judy Patrick mentioned Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, and if you would like to watch Mr. Oliver and his amazing staff's work, you don't have to pay for HBO. The big story is usually posted on YouTube. Little hack.
Yeah, nice.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Speaking of media and subscription fees and collapses, etc., the Associated Press, one of the world's oldest and most influential news organizations, said on Monday, that was yesterday, it's offering buyouts to an unspecified number of U.S.-based journalists as part of an acceleration away from the focus on newspapers and their print journalism that sustained the company since the mid-1800s. The New Media Guild, the union that represents AP journalists, said more than 120 of the staff members it represents received buyout offers yesterday. The news organization is becoming more focused on visual journalism and developing new revenue sources, particularly through companies investing in artificial intelligence, to cope with the economic collapse of many legacy news outlets. Once the lion's share of AP revenue, big newspaper companies now account for 10% of its income. Over the past 4 years, the AP's revenue from newspapers has declined by 25%. Gannett and McClatchy, two of the largest traditional newspaper publishers, dropped the AP in 2024. In recent days, the company learned that Lee Enterprises, publishers of newspapers like the Buffalo News and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and the Richmond Times-Dispatch, are seeking an early exit from a contract with the AP that's due to expire at the end of 2026. The company has doubled the number of video journalists it employs in the United States since 2022, but remnants of a staffing structure built largely to provide stories to newspapers and broadcasters in individual states have remained. This has its roots in American history. The AP was started in the mid-19th century by New York newspapers looking to share the costs of reporting outside their immediate territory. Judy.
First of all, can I say it's ironic that a news organization like the Associated Press wasn't very clear about exactly how many reporters and journalists it was laying off.
Yes.
Ironic, they said hypocritical.
They said it will be less than 5% globally, but there's skepticism that that'll be the case.
You know, we've written many stories criticizing businesses for not being more upfront about what exactly is happening. So the Associated Press is a cooperative, and newspapers relied on it for years, for generations, to provide news from around the world. Today, it has journalists in over 100 countries, and newspapers used it to for information about sports, about stock. We got stock market information from the Associated Press. We got great election results from the Associated Press. Part of the problem, and also, it's very important that we note that the Associated Press establishes standards that so many newspapers, so many media organizations to this day rely on. AP style is whether you use Mr. and Mrs. before honorific titles. All those things are so important. Part of the problem has been that the loss of newspapers and the loss of news holes, the amount of space we have in a newspaper to fill with content. As people became more accustomed to getting their international and national news online, they didn't need the Associated Press, and the newspapers didn't need to fill their newspapers with news from around the world. They focused on local issues. And so more and more, especially small local newspapers, went away from the Associated Press, again, in part because they were charging so much money, and they just could not afford to carry that content. In New York State, my newspaper, my old newspaper, the Daily Gazette, we relied on the Associated Press for state news. Mm-hmm. And over time, what we have seen is the loss of a lot of state news coverage. I went to the LCA, the Legislative Correspondents Association website for New York this morning, and they just have one AP reporter in the LCA at this point covering state news. They used to have three or four reporters covering regional and statewide issues for local newspapers. That is missing now. So part of this is, the Associated Press making decisions. Much like newspapers are making decisions, we decide not to cover things, and people say, oh, you don't have what I want in your newspaper, and so we lose a subscriber. AP loses subscribers as it diminishes its content. But going forward, AP is still the leader in terms of establishing standards for how to vet a video, to make sure a video is real and not AI generated, to set standards about, are they leading the way in terms of fighting for press freedoms when organizations tried to suppress us. I mean, they have been among those who have fighting for our right to say the Gulf of Mexico, not the Gulf of Trump, or was it
America.
The Gulf of America?
Trump.
Sorry,
the Trump of Trump.
But they remain an industry standard and an industry leader, and I wish them well going forward. Things have just changed. I just hope they're not putting too many eggs in the AI basket, because I do not believe that is the future of news.
The union said in a statement that the AP employs hundreds of talented journalists who are willing and able to adjust to the changing media landscape, but the company refuses to offer them appropriate training and tools. Instead, AP continues to get rid of experienced staff and flirt with artificial intelligence, ignoring the opportunity to differentiate AP news stories as ones that are and always have been created by human journalists.
Right, you can't cover news. AI cannot cover news on the ground. To write a really good story, to really cover the news and to find out the truth, you actually have to go to a place and have a person see with their own eyes and ears what's happening.
Bo?
Yeah, so I'll inevitably, as some listeners know, I'll go to data to just emphasize or echo Judy's point. But some of the data is super interesting, and I'll throw it out there for the panelists to comment on. So the Washington Post, as we know, we had a conversation about this a month ago or whatever, 300 journalists let go. The Atlantic Journal-Constitution, 15% of its staff let go. Politico, which is a very big organization, 3%. CBS, although not print journalism, 6% of its staff. The other things that I thought were interesting, Pew Research Center did a survey not that long ago. I think it was in January or December of 2025. 51% of Americans followed the news closely in 2016. Today, it's only 36% follow the news closely. 3,000 newspapers have closed since 2005, right? The Wall Street Journal, just in the last 2 years, has lost 12.9% of its readers, and the New York Times has lost 8.6%. And since 2008, we have 43,000 fewer print journalists working this. So, and I'll say one more thing, and then hand it over to Mark. I want to talk about this from the perspective of what's lost in terms of the American experiment in liberty and the First Amendment and freedom of the press and so on. But I'll hold off until the next section on this. I'll finish by just saying that the decline in trust in the media, which I partly lay at the feet of Trump, but not entirely, the decline in the trust in media is playing a role in this whole new paradigm, right? The new shift in the press. And one out of four Americans have some faith in the media today. 8 years ago, it was 2 out of 4, and 30 years ago, it was 90% of Americans had faith in the media, broadly understood. The fact that we've withered away and that whole trust in the media has declined so precipitously is because, I think, in part, we're in an era where truth is determined by who has the biggest bullhorn, whether it's social media or coming out of governmental offices like the Trump administration. And I do want to talk about other things, but I'll hand it over to Mark for that.
So, Sarah, I look at what's happening at CNN, at the AP, as largely commercial developments. Now, the AP is a cooperative, but it's supported by a number of for-profit institutions, right, who decided that this was the best way to get services that they could then use to sell their product. It's also a great way to have somebody file suit, right? Because it's not the Washington Post. I think the AP is involved, for instance, in the suits against the Pentagon, or is it? Maybe that's the New York Times. But it's probably easier many times to have an industry group do it. I knew I'd be on with Bo today, so I too looked up some stats, and I actually went all the way back.
Dueling stats.
Yeah. So
he's going to outdo me.
Back in when Walter Cronkite was at his peak, he had about 27 million viewers a night. And the combined evening news broadcasts had about 50 million households, so about 42% of the TV audience. Right now, you're down to ABC News, I believe, is the leader. They've got about 9 million viewers, right, which is a much smaller percentage of the household. So, but think about it. In 1791, when the Bill of Rights was adopted, am I right?
Ratified, yes.
Okay, there we go.
Nice. Ooh, extra credit for Mark.
I looked up how big newspapers were, and the biggest newspapers were rags, basically. There were a few pages published weekly or semi-weekly. They had a model that was based on ads, on subscriptions, and many times on a sponsor who wanted their view promulgated, and so they sort of underwrote the thing, including, by the way, some crazy sponsors included Ben Franklin and the like. Oh, yeah. The largest of which probably had a circulation of like a few thousand, so we're talking 0.1% of the population. Some of these things made consistently mendacious claims because they were shill pieces for views. So the fact that the fact that people don't trust the media, the question is, are we going back to a more a la carte menu where, I mean, I don't like what I have to do for my media, like my viewing consumption now. We used to have three channels. You turn them on. There you go. Right now you've got to piece together. Do you want to buy Yeah, I could go through all the brands. How much movie watching do you want?
Well, don't worry. They're all going to be one monopoly pretty soon.
Well, but they're not.
No,
that's
I know.
That's the
believe me, I know.
That's the issue. And by the way, that's why I think that the antitrust stuff around CNN and the rest of it is absurd. The landscape is so fractured that to say there's antitrust in the media right now, given how quickly things are fracturing. So the issue is, I get that, Judy, and I too, there's part of me that says, look, this stinks that sort of these well-known, trusted brand names are going away. But we've been here before with a population that was a little bit less, actually an aggregate population that was far less literate, right? A reading population which was a little less literate as a country. And we figured it out. We got to the truth. So I don't like it. I think the loss of particularly local visibility is something that's troublesome to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see it as – I see it as more of an industry development given what people are and aren't willing to pay for. And I see it as a situation closer to where we've been historically. And we seem to do okay. Now, I also believe you have to be careful about – there is the addiction component to the screens now, which is something we've got to adjust for as a society. There is the local loss of local news. I don't at all dismiss that there are real societal frictions here, but I do think it's an industry development. I think it's inevitable, and I think we need to realize that we've been there before, and we need to do what we can within those economic constraints to minimize the damage.
Speaking of economic constraints, it's time to hear from some underwriters. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. You are listening to the Roundtable Panel, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc here with Joseph Palamountain, Jr., Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, former Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. You can join us by emailing panel at WAMC.org. We are talking about pre-layoffs at the AP. And Beau, you had something to add.
Yeah, I just want to say one thing before I hand it over to the expert in the room, Judy. That is to say, in response to Mark's, I think, quite accurate and erudite analysis of the situation is we're also in a situation that is reminiscent of 1798 John Adams' Sedition Act. So we're back in the late 18th century. Trump himself, as of 24 hours ago, threatens jailing a journalist if the leak from the White House is not revealed by that journalist, right? That smacks of the Sedition Act back in 1798. And so there's a whole lot of forgotten history that is now creeping back into the game.
You know, we talk about a lack of trust in the news industry, but this is part of a societal trend of lack of trust in all institutions. You know, people don't trust the churches like they used to, their banks, their government especially, even the Supreme Court. The lack of trust has been pronounced over the last 25 years. When we talk about it especially has been undermined by the right-wing influencers. I remember listening to Rush Limbaugh's show 25 years ago where he always denounced the Associated Press especially. I think he had a special name for it. I can't remember it. But if you look at Pew Research, they will talk about the lack of trust in the news is especially pronounced among people who tended to bend to the right. Even though it's clear that liberals don't trust Fox News and conservatives don't trust MS Now, but there are gradations of that show that it's clear that the attacks on the press have particularly come from the right. I mean, the president suggesting that whoever released information about the lost airman in Iraq needs to give up their source or face imprisonment. I mean, that's a real concern. He didn't identify what news organization this was. We don't know whether this is just bluster. What it does is chills our ability to report the news. It's very clear that he hates the press. We're the press is the enemy of the people. I mean, saying that again and again, probably at least once a day, has to undermine people's ability to trust the press. It's not that there's less news out there, because clearly there's a lot of news. I don't have time enough to read everything there is out there, to consume as much as there is. But there's clearly a lack of a diminishment in local news, I would say. People aren't covering town, village, county boards like they used to. So you're not seeing that part of government function like you once were able to. The Associated Press was lent an air of professionalism to so much of what the news industry does. I'm glad that they're still here. I'm just sorry they're not covering as much of it as they used to.
I can we take a little detour on the airmen for a second? I was thinking this weekend, first of all, if you listen to Hegseth now, and look, I'm
the holding
don't,
war. If
don't get me wrong, I know pilots who have flown in combat, and they're in my family. So, I mean, praise at any and all appropriate deities that this guy is back and safe. Okay, so let me put his actual safety aside from the conversation. But like, I was thinking of the face of Janice and how the administration was trying so hard to get this guy back, because you know, the minute he got captured, Trump doesn't like people who get captured. Right? I mean, it's amazing
to
me.
Well, he said that, and he changes. Yes. I mean,
well, it's the face of Janice, right? I mean, a minute it didn't go right. Imagine if he would have, the poor guy got captured, it would have been his own fault. It would have had nothing to do with the minute. I just shuddered to think what the other side of that coin was. I also think it does explain, I think, and I don't, these are some random thoughts, but the Savannah Guthrie issue with her mother, and we talk about some of the interest is prurient, but I do think it's great that we as a nation can invest ourselves in individuals and in families and the so deeply in care. I think you do have to, amongst all of the statistics and the concerns around the globe, I do think it's care that the individual plight of one person or a family can matter so much. I think that's terrific.
But what did you think of Hegseth intimating that the airman went into a cave on Good Friday?
Now he's back. He's home or resurrected. Yeah, he was Jesus Christ again. Aside from the airman himself, right? Hegseth's references are just stomach churning, even to those I know who are devout. It's really reprehensible. But I have a question. Nobody in the press, do we agree that no one in the press should be releasing information that compromises that airman's safety while he's trying to evade capture? Do we agree that?
Right, and the press will take steps to make sure that they're not doing that kind of damage.
But if they did, I'm good with a law that says that's bad and we're going to hold you to account. And so I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the exact allegation is, if there was actually information that was leaked that could compromise that guy's safety. But let me tell you, if that happened, I'm good for finding how it happened and holding people to account. I got no problem with that, whether you're a banker, a baker, or the press. Doesn't matter to me.
What if you're the president?
Well, if you're the one who leaked it?
No.
Yeah, no,
always
I look,
just
wait
saying
a second.
Things.
Wait, just to be clear, me and Jack Smith were on the same side of that coin. Aline Cannon and the Supreme Court clearly wasn't. But yeah, back when he was the guy that was the problem, I was all for him facing, assuming he had broken the law, I was all for him facing the consequences. I want to be really consistent. So I'm not sure. I just have a, do we know exactly what happened and
what the allegation
and
is?
What the allegation? No, okay.
You know, in his clear-eyed approach to disseminating information, he was not clear. I mean, it was the Iranians clearly knew a plane went down and that there were airmen aboard. I mean, that was reporting that news was not hurting anyone, because they clearly knew they were chasing this person. What it could have been, and I didn't see this reported, that whether or not one person was still alive, one of the airmen was still alive and hiding. I didn't see that being reported, but that could have been.
I am all about an unrelenting standard. If on one side I get to know 48 hours earlier versus the safety of a downed airman, I'm going with the airman, and if somebody from the press ends up in the clink as a result of abusing that secrecy, I'm all for it.
Yeah, and that's where I think it behooves us to think at a 5,000-foot level, because you're talking, Mark, I agree with you, but you're talking about very subtle and nuanced understanding of the facts of that particular case, as you should, right? You're doing a service to those people who are listening to the show today. My worry is what Judy said when she first started, which is the deterioration of institutions. I have no doubt that Trump is using the threat of jail, not because he has this I need to protect the airmen's safety, but as an intimidation factor for the institutions like the press, universities, law firms, and so on that are central to our democratic experiment. So absolutely, bravo. I'm totally with you, Mark, on the fact that, yeah, if this airman's safety is in jeopardy, that White House leaker ought to face some trouble. But boom, don't think for a minute, that Trump is not using it as an opportunity to once again bash and wreak havoc on our understanding of what is truth and what is not truth.
Well, and not to mention that his aggressive decisions likely put the airmen in danger in the first place.
Yeah.
Without a declared war from the other branches of government.
Yeah, by the way, I know we're not. Well, first of all, I'd be a little bit careful. This assault on
I'm trying to be.
No, I meant to my fellow panelists. This assault on believing institutions. Last time I checked my reference of history, right? That's not an assertion that's particular to the left or the right. As a matter of fact, if you look to the 60s, the left had a pretty good hand in asking us to question, and rightfully so, institutions that we used to give undue deference to in this country, and that maybe we in some cases still do.
But yeah, I don't think the deference is helpful.
And in the 60s, again, probably I'm putting on my liberal hat, somebody, knock it off.
No.
But in the 60s, the threat to institutions or the criticism of institutions was in the service of democracy and more transparency and more democracy. The threat to institutions today is opposite that. It's not in the service of democracy. It's trying to cut down democracy at its knees.
That's a big brush.
Of course. Isn't that why we're paid?
We're getting close to the news, but I get that you could question the subtext of various criticisms, but to say everything on the left was fine and nothing on the right was done for true purposes, let's be careful.
I mean, the church lost trust. The sex abuse scandals led to that. Yeah. The 2008 economic collapse led people to distrust the banking situations. There were banking institutions. There have been a series of major issues that have affected certain institutions, and more so than back in the 60s when it was mild. I think the hippies were, they may have been protesting the war in Vietnam, but maybe they were still tuning into Walter Cronkite at 6 o'clock or 7.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Your panel this morning, Beau Breslin, Judy Patrick, and Mark Whitman, all shall return after news with Ray Graff. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc, here with Joseph Palamountain, Jr. Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, former Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. Before our news break, we were talking about buyouts at the AP and journalism and the collapsing of estates in general, and the shoring up of them and supporting of them as well. Let us talk about another media story. David Ellison and Paramount Skydance have reportedly signed deals to get nearly $24 billion from three Gulf wealth funds to help back its acquisition of Warner Brothers Discovery. Saudi Arabia's public investment fund has agreed to provide roughly $10 billion for the mega media merger, while the Qatar Investment Authority and Abu Dhabi's Limad Holding Company have also signed equity commitments with Paramount. The Wall Street Journal has reported this, citing unnamed sources with knowledge of the matter. The commitments will help offset the cost of the $81 billion deal for Paramount CEO Ellison and his father Larry Ellison, the mega billionaire co-founder of Oracle and a close ally of President Trump's. The Gulf Fund's commitment comes as tensions remain high in West Asia due to the U.S. and Israel's war with Iran, as Iranian strikes have broadened to neighboring regions, including attacks on key energy facilities in Qatar and Saudi Arabia, which could further disrupt global energy markets. Meanwhile, Paramount's deal is awaiting regulatory review in Europe, where it is likely to face more challenges than in the U.S., according to experts. Executives at Paramount, though, have told employees to prepare to close the deal as soon as the end of July, and that, again, is according to the Wall Street Journal. Who would like to start?
You know, here's the thing about an independent... Well, I'll focus on the media, the press part of this. The key thing about an independent press is that it gives you credibility, and it gives you, and ultimately, theoretically, that should lead to increased subscribers and increased viewership, increased everything. Increased credibility does that. But the bottom line here is whoever owns the press, that's where the independence stops. If you own it, you can do whatever you want with it. And that's why there's some concern if one person owns too many news organizations, they might put their thumb heavily on the scale and how they want to report the news. Again, I will maintain till the day I die that independence, credibility relies on being fair-minded, unbiased, as objective as you can be, and then if you fall one way or the other too far, that ultimately will be bad for your organization. But, you know, tell that to Rupert Murdoch, who's made quite a bit of money with his right-leaning organizations. He has shown that this can be effective. We do worry that the independence of CNN will be affected by this, because the Ellisons have proven to be people who believe in one version of the truth. I mean, what I'm seeing from the administration and from people, from conservatives, they want our media to be more patriotic, more more religious, more family friendly, and which sound like really good words, but they can be very bad words. Like, for example, if you want us to just be patriotic, then we don't cover the bad things about our government. And so patriotic seems like a good word, but and religious and family friendly, ultimately they can lead to a distilled press that doesn't look at the truth.
So I'll say one quick thing, and I'll preface this by saying nothing that I'm going to say should be interpreted by folks as xenophobic in any way. That said, that's a big wind-up. That said,
I feel like you're setting up a trap for yourself.
Right, actually.
Here we go.
So it got it, but I find it interesting the role, financial and otherwise, that West Asia, used to be called the Middle East, plays now in a lot of both the global, you know, the global environment, economic and otherwise, but in the United States, right? It used to be that folks from Saudi Arabia had serious investments in particular economic industries. And I think partly because of the sort of liberalization of some of the places in West Asia, you now see their imprint. You now see a West Asian imprint, $24 billion worth in this particular merger, on entertainment and other areas. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm not saying that's good or bad. I just find that when you think about the global shift of investment, it used to be that China, and I'm sure China still is, a major investor in the United States. I think folks in West Asia now are sort of rivaling in some industries those investments in the United States, and we'll see what that means for the evolution and development of those industries. I just find it fascinating. No criticism. I'm not suggesting it's not the right thing to do, but $24 billion, that's a third of the cost. Now, admittedly, the folks who are these organizations that are investing $24 billion don't have voting rights and so on in this particular
company. They did say
company.
Silent partners, although
they are silent partners.
Money talks.
But $24 billion is still a third of that entire transaction. And I find it interesting the role that West Asian folks are now playing in our economy.
I find Judy's idealism laudable.
Thank you.
But I have no problem.
You can stop listening to him now.
No,
of course not.
These are private companies. If Judy and I want to get together and start the Judy and Mark newspaper and spew whatever we want, and our circulation rises to the stars, and we're backed by Viktor Orban and J.D. Vance.
We might have to discuss your participation in the panel if you guys pursue this venture.
Of course. Right. And that would only be proper. But in terms of our commercial endeavor, there's no reason we shouldn't have at it. And I find this historical issue around foreign ownership of U.S. media. I mean, Rupert Murdoch became a U.S. citizen. Sure. So it's a bit of a fiction. So too, by the way, for all the kids in the room, the fact that the Saudis have 24% of, or whatever it is, of the equity, and they quote-unquote don't have a vote, we can all giggle together at that one, right? Let me tell you how that works in reality, right? Particularly given all the other levers a group like that has around the world. So that may technically...
Why do they think we would believe...
Because that's the...
won't have influence.
Oh, because here, let's be clear. And I've done this too when I've organized transactions. There are technical rules that you have to ascribe to, right? And once you've ascribed to them, the rule checker in the government office says, okay, no foreign ownership because you don't have a vote. Check the box.
Right.
So you're good. Now, if the intent of that, which I think it was to limit their influence, they're probably not measuring. I would argue you're not measuring it the right way. But I'd also argue I don't care. I go back to 1791. Let's all publish our own little pamphlets. Now, that puts a tremendous amount of pressure upon the citizenry to get it right, to understand what they're reading, which I would claim even the vaunted New York Times, for God's sake, if you were reading that thing thinking that it was written on stone tablets and came down from a mountain every day, you weren't understanding this world. Particularly, frankly, I would argue you were missing a lot of what was going on in the Middle East historically, and a lot of the transgressions of, frankly, the Israelis. And I could go through. I mean, if you don't think that the Wall Street Journal has become an ever smaller island of truth amongst a lot of nonsense from the right, you've missed what's happened during the Murdoch family ownership of the Wall Street Journal, okay? And if Jeff Bezos wants to buy the Washington Post and taint it with his editorial decisions around what president endorsements they do or don't give out, that's his right. I may shed a tear in the same way I shed a tear when my local coffee shop closes, but that's his right. And I'm okay with it because I am well enough versed in being a discerning customer. The one thing I do think we need to do more of for this country, and our current generation proves it, is social media and the splintering of media outlets and information outlets got way ahead of our populace's ability to sort through the noise. And I do think there needs to be a project, and I think it could be a bipartisan project, to work on that and sort of arming people with the right skills amongst what is inevitably going to be a very new media landscape. But it is not like these papers, any of them, were came down from the heavens on a daily basis, and we should have never kid ourselves about that. And if the Ellersons want to own CNN and turn it upside down and only support Donald Trump, good for them. I'm just going to turn it off, and that's what happens in a free market.
Right, in a free market. Media companies are—it's a business, and people who own the business get to decide. But I was arguing that for a business to be truly successful in the media business, especially, they need a certain amount of credibility that won't come if you're too heavy-handed with political views one way or the other. And
But they don't need that to be successful. Fox News is financially successful. MS Now, I don't know if they're going to be successful, but let's presume they are once they stop obliterating sort of masthead and proposition to consumers. Once they straighten all that out, they won't be unbiased, but they will presumably be successful.
Right, because in this day and age, I think people have found that that's the only way to focus on a certain segment of the audience and try to grab as many of them as possible. But I would argue that instead of a splintering of the media marketplace, you're seeing a greater consolidation via social media, where people, they will just dive into their social media feed every day and try to figure out what news is what. They are not going to five or six different websites. We may do that, but the average consumer is just extracting from their social media feed the news they want. And in that respect, I think there's a consolidation that gives advantage to the bigger companies that can find a spot on the social media feed. The small independent organizations are not going to rise to the top of the feeds, and their stories are not going to be read.
Oh, I actually think I've seen plenty of counterexamples of that. If I go to Substack now, I mean, I can find, there's a guy on there I follow called the Inflation Guy. I mean, that's what he covers, inflation. I mean, that's a pretty niche. That's not a big, so if you want to find it out there,
you have to look.
Well, right. And that, I think that goes back. But look, back in 1791, when you went to the barber or the your beauty shop or your local friend's house and they handed you the two or three rags that they were reading, I don't know if that was a lot different. You had to sort through them and figure it out. I mean,
there weren't barbers back then. You cut your own hair or that sort of thing. That said,
wait, so all those movies are wrong?
Yeah, they're a little exaggerated. So I'm no socialist, right? I'll admit to that among the lovely foursome here. I'm no socialist, and socialist regimes and communities have a very bad track record when it comes to honesty and truth in the media. But I'm always troubled. Mark, you're right about the, you know, sort of free market. I'm always troubled by the influence of dollars, and it reminds me of, you know, of Citizens United in the political world, where Elon Musk can go $285 million to influence the outcome of an election. Dollars does move needles. And so how can a press where the Ellisons of the world have so much money that they can snap, you know, organizations up and change them on a dime, how can we, other than going to Substack, where I might go to Substack and I might think that your inflation guy is some lunatic in his basement at his mom's home, how do we trust what's coming out of the press if dollars is the bottom line? And Judy has told me so many times, I get it. It's a business. I understand it's a business. But I'm looking for some credibility, some legitimacy, something that I can hold on to in an environment in which it probably never was. But I have this fantasy that at one time the media was a little bit more honest and transparent and so on.
Well, but I can give you a list. But I'll also, if I give you that list, if I'm responsible about it, I'll tell you, watch out. I mean, for instance, The Economist is a great source of information, right. But they have a bent. I mean, right. The Financial Times out of London, same thing, right? They're incredibly reliable, but they have a bent. You know, they have a way of looking at the world. And just be careful. You're pulling out big, big, broad paintbrushes. Let's not conflate the discussion around media sources with the ability to spend money and influence elections. I'm all for the fraction. I'm all for whatever the marketplace wants to do with media. I actually think some of the existing constraints about foreign ownership are farcical, and this transaction with the Ellisons proves why. But I think Citizens United was a huge mistake, and if I had a magic wand, I'd do whatever was necessary to make sure the Supreme Court had to see things differently.
All I'm saying in my broad strokes here, all I'm saying is that money in both industries moves the needle in a way that is disconcerting for a democracy like this, where we are relying on others to tell us information. And it's not an exact. It's not an exact analogy to talk about, you know, public funding and or not public funding, super PACs and so on, and the money that influences political elections and the money that influences the press. But if you are, and again, I promised to talk about free speech, and Mark brings up late 18th century America. If you're in a, you know, if you believe in the freedom of the press, if you believe that the First Amendment is the cornerstone of the American liberal experiment, then money can't be the driving factor. And I know it's not exclusively, but it seems to be increasingly.
Well, let's give thanks to generation after generation of newspaper publishers who believed in the higher mission, and they ran their newspapers. They made good money because there was money to be made in newspapers back in the day, but they also believed in the higher calling. I mean, sure, newspapers often lean Democrat or Republican, and many of them had that word right in their title. But there was the understanding among many generations, many families. I mean, newspapers passed from generation to generation that it was important to uphold certain standards. That it wasn't just an industry that made sprockets. That there was more to it than that. Also, let's throw in the fact that out there on the wild, wild west of the internet, there are these AI slop news sites that are just stealing from existing hard news sites and repackaging them and getting the kind of traffic that the originating news site wishes that it could have. And that's happening as well, distorting the public's perception of what's real and what's not.
Chris writes in to panel at WAMC.org and says, billionaires and shady investment firms have bought up all for-profit media. Social media thrives on conflict, not truth, and every company says they are the only company to be trusted. Disney bribes Trump with a settlement. Amazon makes a fake documentary to bribe Trump. And David Ellison parties with Trump. There is no trust to be had at this point. That is from Chris. Carrie writes in and says, nonprofit journalism seems to be taking off. It's a development that can fill in some holes in the landscape, but I also worry that some people who call themselves journalists have not actually trained as a journalist. They haven't covered fires and school boards and understand the impartiality that they need to display. We also heard.
Was Benjamin Franklin trained as a journalist?
No, but he was only a printer. Right?
Every time you guys talk about the late 1700s, I'm reminded about end of empire and how long ago that was and where we might be now.
You know, it's only been in the last 20 or 30 years that the importance of professionalism in journalism has been emphasized in that respect. I mean, back in the 1920s, not the 1720s, but yeah. The 1920s and 30s, they were regular, mostly dudes out there just working the streets and writing the stories. There was not the level of sophistication that came, that started to come maybe in the 1980s and has developed over time. I mean, there's always been some modicum of ethics, but the professional training, I never took a journalism course. I was trained in 18th century poetry, if you want to go
nice,
there, Bo.
All right. Sarah.
I kind
Sarah.
Of do.
Yeah, so do I. Mark and Judy are going to start their newspaper together. Mark and I are going to do a podcast, Late 18th Century America.
Well, it was nice knowing you all. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Let us begin discussing, prompted by a question from a listener, if I can find it. Here we go. Regarding President Trump's statements yesterday and this morning, Patrick writes in and says, does the panel believe the U.S. military will obey all of Trump's orders to destroy all of the key bridges and power plants and other civilian infrastructure in Iran? Are there any limits? We have a couple of minutes before a break, and then we'll start, and then we'll stop, and we'll come back.
I have one sentence, and then I'll pass it on to the smarter people in this group. My one sentence is, I think we would all be foolish if we thought that any international law guardrails are up.
President Trump said it himself that he is the one who establishes what's moral and what's not. He is the only judge of that. I have heard military officials, mostly retirees, talking about how they maybe you could justify whatever is going to happen. There's a wiggle room if it's a certain percentage of civilian resources being affected versus those that are run by people who are fighting the war. I would argue that even soldiers or people who will drink water. And so is that going to be the justification for bombing a desalination plant?
I look back at the Iraq war. At one point, we had 80% of the power turned off in Baghdad, which was probably, I didn't look at the population in Baghdad versus the rest of the country, but probably got half the population there. And we turned off the lights by virtue of bombing power plants. So the one thing I will say is I looked very carefully. Some of that bombing, there's actually bombs that send out these basically strands of what I'll call tinsel. You could tell what a defense analyst I am, that are meant to short power lines and power stations. They actually don't burn it down or blow it up kinetically. And we used a lot of that apparently in Iraq because that's easily undoable, and there was the Colin Powell notion that we were going to own it and want to undo it. So do I believe that we will bomb power stations and bridges? Yes, unfortunately, I think we will, and I think Hegseth's constant purging of the military since he got there probably makes that even more likely.
We will return and continue this conversation after a break. Your panel this morning, Beau Breslin, Judy Patrick, and Mark Whitman. The email address to join us is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, a news break from the BBC, and we will return shortly. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke here with Beau Breslin, Judy Patrick, and Mark Whitman. I interrupted Mark so that we could hear from the Brits. Resume, sir.
So the question from the listener was, would the military actually do this? And I think if you look at history...
To
recap, for those who are just joining our program...
Thank you.
Am I good? How am I doing?
You're doing great.
I could never do your job.
You could.
The question from our erudite listener was... Do we think that the military will actually follow through if President Trump issues the order to destroy bridges and power plants
in Iran tonight?
And the answer is, on my front, is if you look at history, we shut down 80% of the power to Baghdad and justified it last time around. So, yes, I think the military will do it. I also, unfortunately, think we'll use kinetic bombs to blow it all up and burn it, as Trump has suggested. I think the subtlety of rendering them temporarily inoperable doesn't fit Donald Trump's threat because he wants to hasten the fall of this government. It's funny because the only reason this threat works for Donald Trump is because it brings closer the day that he says he's not after, which is the actual real regime change in Iran. And I think that you also have to look at, as I mentioned before the break.
You're off, Mike.
You also have to, as I mentioned before the break, there is this risk that Pete Hegseth and his effort to hollow out the military of those who disagree with the administration, including there was an officer responsible for the theater that included the area around Venezuela where we were bombing fishermen, or I'm sorry, drug runners, whichever it is. I don't know how sure we really are. But and there was some thought that part of that motivation for that resignation was reservations about the legality of that policy. To that point, I think it is incumbent, if you look at Paul Krugman, speaking of Substack, and his writings about the fact that he likens Trump to a terrorist in this regard. And just a little bit of an aside, if you twist your handlebar mustaches and you did want to do what Donald Trump wants, which is to use this threat to encourage the Iranians to basically open up the strait, you wouldn't do it all in one night, for God's sake. You would do it in succession, because once you've fired the one bullet in your chamber, that gun doesn't work anymore, and you've got to go find another threat. So it's not only is it likely a war crime and therefore immoral, but it's insane in terms of how it's being played out. But back to my other point, If you look on Substack, there was a gentleman, Tim Snyder, a Yale historian, mm-hmm. who is basically saying, we've got to be careful about how this administration is going to use the military in Iran, and more, and just as importantly, if not more importantly, how they might use it to overthrow the results or change the results of the last election. I liken this to we were on an airplane with Donald Trump and the, what was he, the mega shaman and those guys, right? They rushed the cockpit, and for God's sake, we got lucky. We got them out of the cockpit. We got the plane landed. Democracy was okay. When I last saw these guys leaving the airport, they were being escorted by law, by authorities, and they were going to spend time in prison. We've let them all out, and we are back on the plane with these guys. So don't for a second tell me Donald Trump would never do that. You could never try that in this country. And Tim Snyder articulates, sorry, I'm getting emotional.
It's allowed.
Tim Snyder enumerates the ways in which Donald Trump could potentially use the military to try and overturn the results of the next election. I think the one thing you have to consider is he'd probably do it in the districts and the states where things are close, which I don't think he enumerates, which I think is a shortcoming. But we all need to be aware, because if these guys all decide to get up at one time from their seats on this airplane again, I don't think we should assume it's all that they need to use the restroom at the same time. They may well be headed for the cockpit again, and we need to be conscientious about it. I think we are in this war with Iran because he was trying to distract from the Epstein files. I will go to my grave with that belief. And I think the fact that they're sitting with us on the plane again and we're about to hold an election in which Donald Trump will probably be significantly neutered, may lose the Senate and or the House and the Senate. I think we should all be aware of the consequences of what we've done to let them back in and what we've done to let them be in charge of this military. I am literally afraid. And I also, frankly, no offense, but Jeffries and Schumer, as our leaders in the counter effort here, I think we need to keep looking for leaders in the counter effort.
You know, this harkens me back to the commercial that six or seven lawmakers issued about, what, 2 or 3 months ago that told the members of the military that they do not need to follow unlawful orders.
Right.
Now, but it puts a lot of pressure on the privates, the captains. I mean, how they are likely thinking, how am I supposed to know what's lawful and what's unlawful? Thereto, the responsibility rises to the mid-level of people in the military. And what Hegseth has been doing is decimating that level of military leadership.
Yep, dismissing people.
Yeah, dismissing people, hundreds of them,
yep.
and to do his bidding. And again, I will say you can rationalize almost anything. And I mean, this is from an administration the first time around. Was Donald Trump suggested that the military could shoot protesters in the legs? I mean, I think that's what precipitated the initial call from the legislators that you don't have to follow unlawful orders. Hopefully, even privates and captains know that you should not be shooting fellow Americans. But we don't know where this is going to go.
Agreed. I also think I'll jump on Mark's bandwagon with the Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries. I think we need new leadership in the Democratic Party. But back to the original question, Sarah, and that came from a listener. I actually think this is a really pivotal moment in the evolution of the war itself in a couple of different ways. One is we can make some assessment of success, right? Militarily, the U.S. has been successful. It has bombed most of the things that it wanted to bomb. Strategically, I said last time I was on the show, we're losing. He's being outcoached. He's being outplayed by the Iranians. And this is a pivotal moment, I think, rhetorically in particular, because you'll notice that ever since the beginning, I think the Trump administration underestimated the ferocity of the way in which Iran would debunk or disagree or snub Trump every time Trump says we're winning the war. whether it's closing the Strait of Hormuz or saying no, the negotiations, Iran saying no, the negotiations aren't there, and no, we're not going to abide by the 15-point plan that Trump put in place, and so on. He is consistently being told no, 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 something that I think he's convinced himself he's not used to, and as a result, the rhetoric has, I think, escalated Trump's actions to the point where we are genuinely thinking about bombing three things: bridges, energy plants, and water salination spots, because of the fact that I think he has no place to go. He's decided there's no off-ramp, so the escalation, which I think is based largely on the rhetoric coming from Iran, has created this pivotal rhetorical and strategic moment.
The Iranians have threatened as their counterattack to hit facilities in the Middle East, including desalinization plants. If they are successful, they can make entire large cities in the Middle East uninhabitable. There are literally evacuation plans on the shelf for if and when desalinization plants are crippled in Saudi Arabia, for instance, for people to leave the cities because they'll need to. Donald Trump had an amazing power. He has been able to focus our strongest enemies on their superpowers. He instituted the tariffs against China, and they figured out the choke point of rare earth minerals, at least for the time being, and were amazingly successful in beating him back. The Iranians now, basically, if they've got some Toyotas and some Shahed drones, probably one every 2 weeks thrown into the Strait of Hormuz keeps them in control for the foreseeable future. They found the superpower. I mean, never mind centrifuges, for gosh sake. Trump has made it really easy to be the winner. And their standard of winning here is just holding on. So congratulations to Donald Trump and the administration for showing our enemies their true superpowers and the limits of American power. It's amazing what this guy has done. And the one thing he cannot do, you know, he can lie about immigration in the United States or talk about dogs and cats in the broiler and in wherever it was that he and J.D. Vance claimed they were being
Ohio somewhere,
right? He can lie about that, and people can get confused. But you can't lie about war, and particularly the price of gas. As The Economist said, his superpower in this circumstance is gone. People know he's lying. This weekend, with the first announcement that we had saved the airmen, allegedly came, my understanding was it came from True Social. I literally said to myself, I'm not believing this until I hear it really confirmed, because it wouldn't be beyond Trump to lie about it and say, and we all know that, right? I mean, it's just...
Yeah. Well, I would say he could have lied about it at the outset. Even there might not have been an airman. Like, I'm not saying that's true, but
right.
I don't put it past him.
But in terms of us sustaining those lies in times of war, that superpower is gone for him. And I think a lot of the frustration, including that swearish tweet you saw on Easter morning.
It right? wasn't swearish. It was profane.
I think that's emblematic of the fact that he's really, I mean, this is a toddler who's really frustrated because the normal stunts that he pulls don't work. He's still got to sit and eat his broccoli, and he can't figure out a way out of this. I will say, as we talk about his mendaciousness and the degradation of media outlets, I'll say it now, thank God for public radio, because I literally turned the station on and I said, I'm not believing that airman thing until I hear it. And so, too, when I see some of these videos, when I saw the Cash Patel video in the locker room, I thought that was AI. I thought, no,
it shouldn't have been real.
There's no way. Imagine William Webster or somebody. I thought, wait till I see that, a credible source say that that's really, this guy really debased himself in that way. I'm not going to believe it. It's really sad. But I would encourage people to take a look at Krugman's Substack and Tim Snyder. I mean, Krugman, laments the fact that we as a country are being pulled into this. by Donald Trump. And by the way, maybe we should just all call a Republican today and ask them, a Republican in national leadership, and ask them, is it a war now? When does this become a war, for gosh sake? Right?
Yeah, and I don't think we should walk away from this conversation without watching what the, or without talking about what the Republicans are saying in reference to these, the profane, the tweets. Today, he's talking about wiping out an entire civilization.
You're not exaggerating.
This is madness. Yeah. Yesterday, he's standing next to the Easter Bunny at the Easter egg hunt, and he's talking about, you know, killing thousands of people while all the little kids are running around gathering eggs.
Oh, chatting with the kids.
Just to be clear, I don't doubt you for a moment. But did that really?
Yes.
Yes.
He was chatting with the kids.
Yeah, you could hear the music in the background as he was doing this. I mean, this is not someone who is of a right mind at this point. I mean, I hear Republicans say, oh, that's just Trump being Trump. This is not a normal person. We are in not normal times. This is not statesmanship.
But was he ever normal? The problem I have then, they're like, oh, let's invoke the 25th. Amendment. Yep. Oh, am I right?
Yeah. All of yesterday's email was like, what about the 25th? What about the 25th?
Well, but by the way, the 25th thing, remember the first guy he tried to put as Attorney General was Matt Gaetz.
Yeah.
Matt Gaetz, okay?
Right.
I mean, Pam Bondi was like an upgrade, kids, right?
And Cash Patel is going to be the next one.
He's got Cash Patel, and he's got Pete. Why did he put those guys in on his blind side? Because in his last administration, those were the groups, those were the officers in his cabinet that somewhat constrained him. I mean, they literally kind of threw their bodies down on the roadway, and they were at least road bumps as he drove over them and tried new ones on.
Another Mark Whitman metaphor.
But this time round, right, he's got these guys just waving them through, and Pam Bondi got fired. Because you can't fool judges and for gosh sake, grand juries, right, into total stupidity, trying to. So now that he's got these people in place, I mean, the lament of Paul Krugman that this guy is going to, on behalf of all of us, potentially commit these horrible war crimes and this ill-considered, what do we call this Project Epic failure now? I mean, and again, I'm not rooting against, let's all call it that. I'm not rooting against the military, right? That's a whole different.
Yeah, yeah. Of course.
Whole different kettle of worms or whatever. I mean, I have a tremendous respect for those people and what they've done technically, but you can't, no matter how good your bombing is, if your plan is entirely ill-considered from the beginning, you can use all your bombs, which looks like we're getting close to doing, and you've still got an ill-considered plan at the end of it. This is egregious.
Do we have a moment?
Yeah.
This is an honest question to the three of you. Is there a Republican voice out there that will be taken somewhat seriously, recognizing that the traditional, the traditional anybody but Trump Republican voices are no longer sort of credible. But is there a voice that can answer Judy's question about madness, right? That is, because the 25th Amendment is not going to be invoked. He's surrounded by sycophants. And I'm thinking of George W. Bush. Is George W. Bush so, he's not going to get out there, but would his voice make a difference in the midterms and or the presidential election, or have the Republicans just essentially kowtowed to Trump fully?
Go fish on that one. You got to go get another card, because George Bush criticizing an ill-considered war in the Middle East
that's
not going to work.
Right. I think that obviously
I think
that's fair.
But your project is honorable. Well,
Mitt Romney doesn't have the credibility anymore.
No, he also doesn't. I think
hammered.
His vertebrae doesn't go all the way up either. He's got some bit of a stiff. You know, Pete Hanks has said that the Strait of Hormuz would be open except for the fact that it's closed because of bombing. John McCain would be alive except for the fact that he's dead if you're Pete Hanks. I wish we could get like a John McCain, right? Yeah. Which is what we're looking for, is somebody who has impeccable credentials, who you may have not liked the guy or disagreed with him, but you knew he had the interests of America at heart, right? There was not, I mean, he'd prove that from, any day as an adult. I wish there was somebody like that. I don't know who it is. I don't even who sat on the. I mean, who's that on the Democratic side? You know, but the good news is,
I think Obama could say. But
I hear
but nobody's going to
that
take Obama
Chuck
seriously.
Schumer has written a strongly worded letter to the administration. So I think it may get better soon.
Carol writes in to panel at WAMC.org and says, totally agree with you on the leadership of Schumer and Jeffries. I've sent emails to everyone I can think of telling them that they can count me out until they are gone and all of the junk mail I get from them ceases. We also heard from Anne Marie, who says, can Congress call an emergency session to halt Trump's plan to, quote, annihilate a civilization, end quote?
I mean, the answer is no, because, you know, Mike Johnson's never going to call anything that's even remotely anti-Trump.
Speaking of invertebrates.
We also heard from John, who says, wow, if you don't like Schumer or Jeffries, maybe you prefer Thune or Johnson. Now, no, you go to war with the army you have, not the one you wish you had. If the Republicans had any principles, we would not be here. Stop blaming the Dems.
Oh, that's not true. That's not true. There are, you know, there are Democrats on in the Senate and in the House that I think would be more effective leaders. And I think that's basically what Mark was saying.
I just wish they had a merciless tactician.
Yeah.
Right. Who could stand up and say, look, I mean, somebody needs to they need to have a press conference saying, look, here's what we fear Trump's going to do if he does. Here's our counter plan in each of these. And in a lot of ways, and again, read the Tim Snyder piece, it sounds like what we tried to do before the Russian invasion into Ukraine to make sure that the disinformation part of it, at least, didn't work. And there wasn't this, oh, did the Ukrainians start it or did they not? From the get-go, it was like the Ukrainians, we know who the good guys were and the bad guys were, and we pursued things accordingly. I think they need to get somebody in the Democratic Party to stand up and do that. And it would be great if there were a Republican with a conscience that we could all listen to as a critic of what Donald Trump is doing here. But I don't know who that is.
Well, I think I'll say a couple of things. One is the Democrats need someone on the left like Mitch McConnell performed on the right, right? And you can I've always said that Mitch McConnell was the most dangerous person in government when he was in power. But he was a super effective leader of that party in a way that Chuck Schumer has not shown effectiveness. Harry Reid was a better leader of the Democratic Party in the Senate than Chuck Schumer is. So there are people out there. I'm just not sure why Chuck Schumer in particular, Hakeem Jeffries, I think, is not quite not as good, but not quite as bad as Schumer. I'm not sure why Chuck Schumer still is maintaining power.
I think Nancy Pelosi was a good tactician as well. And the hope has always been that she is tutoring Hakeem Jeffries into a better performance in that role. But I'm not seeing it. I think she's cashed out.
Well, the other thing I'll add to this is that if the Democrats and the midterms are coming up, let's assuming the midterms are going to happen. And if the Democrats don't come away with a 35-seat majority, that's a general loss for the Democrats. They should at least come up with a 35-seat majority. And the fact that the Senate, although somewhat in play, is not clear-cut for the Democrats suggests that the Democrats' popularity is so low, lower than Republicans, that has to do with leadership. And so, you know, we don't have a Nancy Pelosi doing the work that is necessary. The Democrats should not be this close in the Senate. And, you know, I get that it's not going to be 60-40, but it should be the Democrat majority. And I'm not sure today, if today were the day, I'm pretty sure the Republicans would hold on to the Senate.
I heard something really scary this morning from pretty credible reporting from China, which is that they want this, even though this war is costing them money in terms of energy costs and in terms of potential degradation of their foreign markets, they want it to continue because it is so representing a diminution in the authority and power of America. But they don't want it to continue so long that Donald Trump is out of office because they think he's basically their perfect patsy now, particularly that he's going to be wounded for the rest of his term. I mean, just give that a thought for a moment, that the Chinese have said, yeah, we want you to fight on for a bit, but not so long that you recover from Donald, that America recovers from Donald Trump. They want us to be burdened with him for as long as reasonably possible here.
Joanne writes and says, I hope the world is aware that many Americans detest what is being done in Iran, and while I celebrate the safe return of the servicemen, as a Catholic, I'm appalled at the resurrection analogy that Hegseth made. And we also heard from Diane, who says, I think Trump's radical threat to destroy a civilization in Iran could mark the end of the United States as a global world leader. If he doesn't make good on the threat, he has shown himself and the U.S. to be a paper tiger. If he succeeds in any respect, he'll mark the start of World War III. Think of the powerful allies, China and Russia, that might come to Iran's defense, as we've just said. We are out of time for this morning. Your panel was Beau Breslin, Judy Patrick, and Mark Whitman. Joe Donahue will return tomorrow to host the show. Thank you all for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
You
are listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.